WNST Towson Baltimore and Baltimore Positive. We are positively into the summertime, and I can't get enough Orioles right now, right? I mean, the Ravens taking their little respite, and Luke will be in Owings Mills as well as in Wildwood later on in the month as we get into summer. But, you know, these news drops and the aftermath of COVID for sports has just changed the landscape in so many ways. We're going to be talking about it out on the Maryland Crab Cake Tour. You can go check out our dates and our partnership with the Maryland Lottery in conjunction with our friends at Window Nation. But this golf situation and the Live and the PGA, I think of one person around here when we think of golf. He's written so many books, has a brand new book out on golf and the remarkably funny and tragic journey of golf's David Ferraty. He once wrote a book on the Ravens that I tried very desperately to emulate Purple Rain to. We welcome John Feinstein back onto the program. John, I thought of you when this whole thing happened immediately, and I guess, you know, I'm reading what Christine Brennan has to say, and I'm out on, and then the Trump indictments happen on the other end. I mean, maybe the PGA had this thing figured out or whatever, but it's been kind of a wild ride for golf, really, ever since the Saudis decided to sink money into it. And how are you? And congratulations on the book, and I'm sorry I'm hijacking you, but the whole PGA thing's been hijacked this week.
Well, yeah, it has. In fact, I was supposed to appear on Golf Channel to promote the Ferraty book on Wednesday. And along comes Jay Monahan announcing that he's folded his tent to the Saudis. And guess what? I wasn't on Golf Channel on Wednesday because they were all PGA Tour LIV all day. But, the last two chapters of the Ferraty book are about his decision to move to LIV. And David, unlike a lot of people who made the move to LIV, was very honest about it. When he was asked why he did it, he said, "I did it for the blanking money." He was offered, like a lot of the guys, stupid money to move from NBC to LIV and wanted to do it, wanted to be in the 18th tower, which he never would be at a network because he wasn't a major, major winner. He finished fourth once at the British Open, but never won a major. I was kind of familiar with what was going on even before the news broke on Tuesday. Now, having said that, I had no idea it was going to happen this soon. David and I agreed when we were talking for the book that eventually there would probably be some kind of merger between LIV and the PGA Tour. I mean, for all the Jay Monahan self-righteous declarations about, oh my God, I feel for the 9/11 families and at least if you play for the PGA Tour, you never have to apologize for anything we've done. Well, that's no longer true. We thought the merger would come much later than this, that it would be 2, 3, 4 years down the road. And we knew the Saudis wouldn't run out of money because they won't. And that at some point you had to get the best players in the world back together playing against one another. That's why the NFL merged with the AFL. That's why the NBA merged with the ABA. And that's why the NHL merged with the WHA. But and now that'll happen. That's the good news in this is that the players, the best players in the world, will be playing against one another again, which did not happen in the last year with LIV, except at the major championships. So I was stunned by the news, and I was also stunned by the fact that Jay Monahan basically folded his tent. I mean, the commissioner of golf now is Mohammed bin Salman, the crown prince of Saudi Arabia, who we know is a murderer. And he's the commissioner of golf now. So did the PGA Tour and Jay Monahan sell its soul? Absolutely. But it sold its soul for a heck of a lot of money. And that's the way Jay Monahan's going to pitch this whole thing.
You know, John, I flew to China back in 07 with Cal Ripken doing a baseball thing before Beijing. And when I landed in that part of the world, it was striking to me how big golf was, right? Like Tiger Woods is everywhere at that point. Yeah. Next to Yao Ming. But there, no mention of anything Western, really, other than the NBA. And I saw golf, and then you land in Japan and see golf, and then you land in Australia, and obviously Greg Norman, and you see golf. And then you, like, with South Africa, and obviously with the winners, and that Your attraction to golf, and I spoke at length this week. I was out on a golf course Monday. I know you find that hard to believe. We did the Mount Washington Pediatric Hospital, the annual event. Leonard Raskin's a dear friend and a sponsor, and we rode around and made a lot of money for kids. And it was a, we talked about golf and how I didn't grow up with it, right? I grew up in Dundalk, Aparicio, played baseball, didn't play soccer. Talked to Pete Carringi over at UMBC, but the things you grew up with, golf. To me, it feels like I don't know your back. I think of you and I think of college basketball and golf. We can get to Orioles, Lamar, a lot of things. You've written books on baseball with my buddy Messina and all that. But I think of you with college basketball and golf. Your golf beginning in all of this and all the writing you've done. Golf's always been a mess, right? And golf is always maybe like boxing or something vulnerable to big money and vulnerable to, or even horse racing, sort of vulnerable to being bought off because it never. It was the PGA and nothing else. They didn't let black people in. They didn't let women in. Everybody sort of looked the other way. And everyone else had to always fight and claw and go. Like golf was never sort of on the up and up as I saw it coming into it, that it wasn't always welcoming to everyone, but it's all over the world and all this money. Why did golf get targeted in all of this stuff by the Saudis?
Oh, because of what you just said, because it is a worldwide sport, because they knew there were a lot of players they could target to get to play on their tour. They knew that most golfers, like most athletes, will take the money. And I don't think that makes you a bad person. Harold Varner III, one of the few black players on the PGA Tour, said this is generational money. I can take care of my kids and my grandkids with this money. Now, Phil Mickelson admitted the Saudis were, his words, murderous MFs, but said, oh, I'm going to help grow the game and this will change the game. Well, it has changed the game. You have to say that. But, excuse me.
Do you think that they really believe they would just own it within a couple, three,
No.
4 years? That
Oh.
I mean, they have the money to buy whatever they want, including
Right.
a presidency if they so choose.
Well, the threat now to me is, will they start trying to buy American sports teams? Will they, they already own soccer teams in the Premier League. What if somebody came and offered Steve Bisciotti, $10 billion for the Ravens? Who knows what would happen? I'd like to think Steve would say no, but who knows? I mean, if they offered it to
You'd like
Dan
to think
Snyder.
Roger Goodell would say no to money?
Well, yeah, exactly. That's the point. You'd have to trust the NFL owners to say, we don't want this to be part of who we are. And we've already got so much money.
We all thought Jay Monahan had integrity a couple days ago, right? Literally,
Yeah,
right?
that's
Maybe.
true. That's exactly right. And so that's why it's a little bit scary. But the Saudis, they already hosted golf tournaments in Saudi Arabia. They paid a lot of guys big money guarantees to come over and play. By the way, Tiger Woods and Rory McIlroy turned down seven-figure guarantees because they didn't feel right about playing there, to their credit, and of course turned down hundreds of millions of dollars to join the Saudi tour. But golf's growth is remarkable. I mean, your point about race is important. Before 1963, the PGA of America had a Caucasians-only clause in its bylaws and only removed it after the Attorney General of California threatened to shut down the LA Open, which was a big event in those days, if they didn't remove it. So it was removed by force, basically. And, Augusta, the Masters didn't have a black participant till 1975. They didn't have a black member till 1990. They didn't have a female member till 2012. Golf has been
2012.
2012, 2012. Golf
2012.
has been a white man's playground for many years, but it has gradually changed because of so many players coming from across the sea, so to speak.
The targeting and the sports washing, I'll use that for the first, because that's the buzzword, right? Of not just this, but Russia, Olympics, World Cups, Qatar. I
Yep.
mean, it's
Three-day
just
tournament.
sitting there like this isn't the first thing to be corrupted. It's
No.
just the thing that's come to the front door here to say there are golf courses everywhere and we all love golf and it's down the street and it feels like America owns a piece of it because of the Masters, even though we let the British play a little bit and accept their tour. And but this feels to me like what's next? I'm trying to figure out. You've already gone to the NFL, but this happened pretty quickly. Did it? If it was a war, they won it pretty quickly and pretty fairly, and just threw money at it and choked it, literally.
Yeah, well, money is the most important word in our language, because it money, they say money can't buy happiness, but it sure as heck doesn't hurt.
To buy golfers.
You can buy golf, or you can buy a lot of athletes. I was actually surprised when Lionel Messi announced the other day he's coming to Miami rather than going to Saudi Arabia, because he'd get paid more in Saudi Arabia. But he's got a place in Florida. His family likes living there, so good for him. But money answers almost everything. And so why did these players jump to the LIV Tour last year? Money. And why is Jay Monahan folding to the LIV Tour now? Money. And part of that money issue, though, Nestor, it isn't just how much the golfers will make or Jay Monahan will make. It's litigation. Because the tour and LIV had filed suits against one another. The tour is a tax-exempt organization, even though it makes millions of dollars. And they didn't want to open their books, which they would have had to at the start of the, during discovery, at the start of the trial, any trial or litigation. And they were facing possible antitrust violations
So the
because
Saudis took advantage of American law, basically.
yeah, they did. I mean, nobody says these guys are dumb. And yeah, because if the PGA Tour went into court and said, well, they can't have a tour, only we can have a tour. Well, that's antitrust. That's violation of antitrust right there. And that scares people in sports to be charged with antitrust. That's one of the few things that got the Major League Baseball owners' attention back during the 1995 strike, although it took Sonia Sotomayor saying, you can't collectively bargain without bargaining to get baseball players back on the field.
Well, I'd say one of the reasons the Nationals exist and the Orioles are in the shape they're in was the threat of antitrust and senators in Washington, D.C. John, I know you're woke in all of this, and the Trump stuff happens, and Trump's so golfed up and so Saudied up, and I just the timing of all of this week has been just kind of extraordinary in regard to America and sports and the value of what sports represents on a global stage in regard to politics. I remember seeing a piece with Bob Marley, years ago about how the government tried to usurp him for their own benefit based on his fame and soccer, along the ways of Colombia and different things where sports has been involved. But boy, sports and politics and money, it's just it's really come to the forefront yet again, right?
Well, I always laugh when I write a column or write anything that where I bring politics into it. My book Raise a Fist, Take a Knee, about race and sports. Obviously, there was a lot of politics in that book. The guys kneeling, the fans' reaction, and I always, people say, stay in your lane, stick to sports. Sports and politics have mixed together. Since the first Olympics in ancient Greece, Nestor, and of course we don't remember, but we all certainly know about what happened in Berlin in 1936. We know what happened in Munich in 1972, and politics have been one of the keys for baseball was Congress granting them the antitrust exemption years and years and years ago. So politics have always been a part of sports. That's nothing new. Donald Trump once owned a USFL team. He tried to sue the NFL, actually won the lawsuit, the antitrust lawsuit, but was awarded the USFL was awarded a total of $3 by the jury. And like you said, his obsession is golf and wanting to own golf courses, which he does, And he desperately wants to host a major championship, a men's major championship. He has hosted a women's major championship and would have hosted the 2022 PGA in Bedminster, New Jersey, if not for the January 6th riots. It was taken away from him as a result. And now here he is again, because he has been, I wrote in my column in the Washington Post about all this yesterday. And it my hands are still shaking from writing the words. But one of the winners in all this is Donald Trump, because he supported LIV from the beginning, because he felt the PGA Tour had deserted him, moving their tournament out of Doral, which he now owns. And he was rah-rah for LIV right from the beginning. His courses are hosting three tournaments this year. I was in New Jersey last year when David Faraday did his first LIV tournament, and Trump was all over the place. He was the first guy to tee off in the pro-am. He was walking around the golf course, shaking hands and with everybody. And, the Secret Service was all over the place, and you had to fill out forms to get on the grounds with a press credential. I didn't bother doing that, for the record. And now, that part of this agreement is that there are going to be tournaments at Trump courses, under the new umbrella, whatever form it takes. And you have to say, this is a victory, a sports slash political victory for Trump.
Certainly, one of your colleagues was murdered by this group. You
Yeah,
know,
exactly.
yeah. So the book is Faraday: The Remarkably Funny and Tragic Journey of Golf's David Faraday. It is Father's Day, so I want to remind everybody. Makes the Faraday thing with you seems like strange bedfellows politically to some degree,
To
and
some
for
degree.
him to be one of the guys on the other side, and you writing this book at this time. I've known you to sort of go. And interview the other side and talk to the other side and try to present. You've been doing that since Bobby Knight, presenting the other side. But I would say for this particular time, where are you with Faraday in all of this, who seems like a jovial fellow? And I like Mickelson and like all of that until they start taking blood money of the people that have killed fellow journalists and your coworker.
Yeah. Well, David and I have known each other for 30 years. I first met him when he came to the United States. He had been playing in Europe very successfully. He was on the 91 Ryder Cup team, in the famous War by the Shore, and beat Payne Stewart, who was the US Open champion in the singles. I mean, when David talks about his golf, you'd think he was a 10 handicapper. He was a very good player in Europe, won 5 times over there. But he
Not a
had
Bob Uecker, to use the expression, right? No, not at all.
Far from Bob Uecker.
Right.
But he had to come to the United States. Part of the story is that his wife left him, just left him a note saying, move to Dallas. And they had 2 young boys. So David wanted to be with his boys. So he moved to Dallas, and had to go to PGA Tour qualifying school, because what he had done in Europe meant nothing over here. And I met him at Q School, because that was the year I was writing A Good Walk Spoiled, and met him further at the orientation session for PGA Tour rookies, because even though, again, he was 35 years old and an accomplished player, he had to go through that orientation.
But he would, there's no chance he wasn't going to make it, right?
Well, you would think not, but golf is
Right.
golf. I mean, he
Right.
made it easily, as it turned
Right.
out. But I found him instantly funny and honest. I was in a session where this woman was telling the players how to talk to the media. And it was basically the Bull Durham speech, the Kevin Costner Bull Durham speech. Always say you want to step up and give 110%, give thanks to God, talk about how much you love your colleagues as opposed to teammates. And David was actually passed out in the back with a hangover through most of her speech. And finally, he woke up, listened to what she was saying, put up his hand, and said, "I have a question. Is there any reason why we can't just tell the truth?" And at that moment, I said, "This is a guy I want to get to know better." And we became friends over the years. As I said, he was a very good player. And
Is this the
he,
forward to the book in some way?
yeah, it is. Very much so. Good call.
Ha
He was very close to Tom Watson, because Tom, who's an alcoholic, helped him deal with his alcoholism. He's been on and off the wagon many, many times throughout his life, but Tom really helped him. And so David began coming to the golf tournament, Tom and I put on first at Caves Valley. to raise money for ALS research. And he was our dinner speaker because he couldn't play anymore because his back was a mess. And he cracked people up. I mean, just literally, David and Jim Valvano are the only two people I ever met who could have people literally fall off their chairs laughing. And we became close working on that event together. And as I got to know him more, I realized his story was fascinating. Growing up in Northern Ireland during the Troubles, turning pro when he was a five handicap at 17, which is good for you or me, but not for someone trying to play the game for a living. Becoming an accomplished player, then going through the horrible divorce he went through, happy remarriage, and then being hired by CBS because Gary McCord discovered him telling stories in the locker room one day and said, "This is the funniest guy I've ever heard." And became a star, of course, at CBS, had his own show, Faherty, on Golf Channel, which is easily the best show Golf Channel ever had, and then moving to NBC. So we had been in touch. We would always have dinner when we were both at a tournament. And I love the guy. Our politics are different, but he's not crazy right wing. He's moderate. He's far more moderate than I am.
But
And
writing
he is.
about him at this point when he was one of the defectors, I guess there are no defectors anymore, right? Like,
When I started the book long before this happened, I started my research in the summer of 2021, and I was just about done writing the book when the live thing happened. And I sent him a text and I said, "Are you kidding me? I have to rewrite the last two chapters of this book so you can make a measly couple million extra dollars." And he wrote me back and said, "It's not a measly couple million extra dollars. It was a lot more than that." But I did rewrite the last two chapters to include his decision to go to Live and what Live was about. And that's why I said at the beginning here that I knew a lot more about Live and what went on behind the scenes before all this happened than most people, but I still didn't see it coming.
I have friends that work at Fox Sports. I have friends that I see that I worked with who, have put a bow tie on and gone into dugouts and put the Fox Sports look. And I think about the poison that's been created. I don't know where taking money and doing a job in America even is anymore, but the NIL, and I want to sort of transition into that a little bit. Where are you with that part of what this has done to college sports? Because I saw Gary Williams speak, I don't know, maybe about 8, 10 weeks ago. He came up to Baltimore and did a networking thing, and he said that there'll be guardrails put in. And I'm like, I think there's lawyers out here ready to make sure there are never guardrails put in. And the money that's now pouring into college sports, John, I'll be honest, it's just made me like college sports a whole lot less. And I was always sort of teetering. I wasn't the guy hanging at Maryland or at even at UMBC as much as I have in the early part of my life. And now you need a scorecard you can't keep up with it. The coaches can't even keep up with it. The recruiters can't even keep up with it. And I just see this industry bubbling up of all of these legitimate people, former people that worked at universities that are now on the dark side of figuring out how to basically get money to young people and funnel them into a college. I mean, it's the plague has changed the world, man. Like this last 5 years, we have to recalibrate all of this.
Well, it's chaos, and you have to include the transfer portal as part of that chaos because I was down at VCU a couple of days ago and I had lunch with Ryan Odom. They have nine new players off a team that was in the NCAA tournament last year. They have one starter back, and they only had two seniors on that team, and only one of them started.
His
And
job is so much different than his father's, right? It's a
that
different
completely.
world.
Completely different world, and he's got to deal with NILs. He's got to deal with the transfer portal. Everybody does. The transfer portal is even a factor for Division III schools, where kids say, "Well, I think I can play Division I." They all think they can become the kid in Miami now, whose name I always block on, but who went from Williams to Michigan to the NBA. They all think that can happen for them. It isn't. But the problem is, Gary says there'll be guardrails. Well, that would be nice, but like you said, the minute somebody goes in and tries to limit NILs, the NCAA or a conference or whomever it might be, there is going to be somebody in court saying, "Wait a minute, Supreme Court already ruled on this. The players own their name, images, and likenesses, not you. You can't tell him he can make only this much or she can only make this much, because women's basketball is becoming more and more a moneymaker. The NCAA blew this whole thing, screwed the pooch, as the astronauts used to say, when instead of knowing that legally there was no way to fight the notion that a person can't own his name and image and likeness, they fought it to the Supreme Court. They spent God knows how much money on legal fees, knowing they had to know they were going to lose. They lost 9-0.
Well, John, it's part of almost like sort of the PGA saying, well, we know we're going to lose eventually. Might as well throw the
Right.
towel in this week. Take the money
Well,
and run.
they saved themselves a lot of money in legal fees, if nothing else. But it wasn't even so much the money they wasted on the legal fees. It was that they were totally unprepared when the Supreme Court ruled against them, which was, again, it was a conservative court, and they still ruled against them 9-0. Instead, what they should have done was they should have gone in and started negotiating with the players 5 years ago. Okay, you own your name, images, and likenesses. Let's put some guardrails in. And Gary's right, there should be guardrails, but I don't see how you stop it. I don't see how you stop it, because in a utopian world, this is the right thing. But we live a long way from utopia.
Well, we're going to figure that out. John, Dan Snyder, and I don't bother you much with this over the years. Obviously, I've had my own issues that you could read at length of what Chad Steele and the Baltimore Ravens have tried to do to me and my company. I've witnessed what Snyder has done to you as a Washington Post reporter and to, it didn't matter what media company it was, whether it's a city paper down there and all the ridiculousness of all of it. The Snyder thing and the football thing in DC, I mean, you followed this your whole life professionally, and you've gotten away from it because it became something that was not of interest to the public. How do they put that back together again? And is it really over?
Well, I think it's close to over. I mean, it's not, as Yogi Berra used to say, it ain't over till it's over. But it looks like the NFL is moving as quickly as it can to allow this sale to Josh Harris to go through. When I first came to Washington, which is a long time ago, Nestor, as you know, the football team was an obsession. At that point in time, there was no hockey team, there was no baseball team, there was no basketball team. There was the football team, and they were pretty good. They were good under George Allen, and then of course they were great under Joe Gibbs. But I remember when I was in college, because my parents moved here when I was in college, going on a Sunday afternoon to the Giant, and it was empty. It was the best time to shop because everybody was watching the football team. And I still remember when I covered Maryland, Jerry Claiborne saying to me, "All I ever read in your newspaper is Redskins, Redskins, Redskins." Because my job on Sundays was to write a sidebar on the NFL game, and to call Jerry Claiborne to write a follow on the Maryland football game. And he would hear the crowd in the background when I called him, and he'd say, "You're at the Redskins game, aren't you?" "Yes, sir, I am." But it changed, and it stayed that way really through the 90s. And then Dan Snyder bought the team, and he began tearing it apart piece by piece. He made stupid signings of over-the-hill players. He tried to tell the coaches how to coach the team. You know the famous story about Mike Nolan, who became the defensive coordinator for the Ravens, when he said, your defense is too vanilla. And they lost a game because Dan Snyder knew so much about football, right? They lost a game in Dallas, and Nolan went straight to the office after they got home, and there were several pints of melting Häagen-Dazs flavored ice cream on his desk with a note saying, "This is what I want. I don't like vanilla." That's who Dan Snyder was, is. You mentioned the city paper, the ridiculous lawsuit, what he tried to do to our paper, banning TV people from the practice, from the facility, who didn't suck up to the team. Or at one point, the only local TV that was allowed into the practice facility was WRC, because they were paying a rights fee and everybody else had to work from outside. Anyway, we all know it's been a disaster. We all know Dan Snyder is a smarmy little man and a bad guy. And I'm not a fan of the team. I grew up in New York. But I feel for my friends from this town. The same way if I felt for Colts fans in 1984,
Well, I mean,
because
everything you said, Angelos is pretty much done here. I mean, and they're
but
trying to unbury from it right now with a really good team, right?
you have a really good team. Mike Elias has done a terrific job. Brandon Hyde's done a terrific job. And that's nice to see. I always loved going to both ballparks. I loved going to Memorial Stadium and I love going to Camden Yards. But it's been a nightmare for fans of this football team. And I feel for them, even though I'm not a fan of the football team. And I think it'll take a while. But if Josh Harris is a normal, reasonable owner and hires the right people, it'll get turned around.
Anything on Lamar and money? I mean, you spent a lot of time with the Ravens a number of years ago. It was just a fascinating offseason, fascinating that neither one had any other chair to go to. Like, it was just – it's a felt like a shotgun marriage to some degree in them saying, well, and what does Bisciotti care? He's making $200 million a year, literally, just breathing and having the team.
Right.
If they don't win, at least he took his best shot and they didn't have to rebuild it.
Well, here's the thing. Last fall – when all the NFL insiders started writing that Lamar was going to leave the Ravens, that he was going to get traded because they didn't want to, you know, they didn't want to tag him and they didn't want to lose him a year later, whatever. I said and I wrote, Lamar Jackson's not going anywhere. The Ravens are too smart to let a potential Hall of Fame quarterback leave town, leave their team. Sure, he's been injured the last 2 years, but he is a unique talent. And Eric DaCosta and Ozzie Newsome are still in charge of the football program. And they weren't going to let Lamar leave. If they had to tag him for a year, they'd have tagged him for a year. But as you know, they tagged him in a way that allowed him to go out and check the market. And when he checked the market, he found that nobody was willing to like double the money he was making. So he re-signed with a team he knows, with a coach he knows. I think it was an all's well that ends well situation, although it's not the end, it's the beginning, because he's going to be there for at least five more years. And I think the Ravens did the right thing, and I think Lamar Jackson did the right thing.
You think they're going to win a Super Bowl?
I think it's entirely possible. I mean, they've been good enough when he's healthy to win a Super Bowl. They were 14-2 in his MVP season. I still haven't figured out how they lost that game to the Titans, but they did. And, you know, the problem, the thing in football is because the playoffs are one and done. It's not like the NBA, the NHL or baseball. The playoffs are one and done. So you lose 1 year when you shouldn't. You lose another year when you probably should because of injuries. And people are saying, well, his playoff record is terrible. What is he quarterback? Three playoff games? The fact that it's more or less taken for granted in Baltimore that the Ravens will be in the playoffs. Do you know how much people in Washington would love to have that kind of problem? Or in most cities, frankly. Will he win a Super Bowl? It's hard to win a Super Bowl. You can be really good and not win a Super Bowl. Joe Burrow's not won a Super Bowl, but he's pretty darn good. So if you said to me, I think there's a good chance, but is it a lock? Of course not.
What else are you doing besides post the Verity book? You still your podcast? What are you doing? You're always busy, man.
Well, right now I'm promoting the Verity book with Father's Day coming up. Obviously, I'm still writing for the Post on a regular basis, but I've started research on a book on Ivy League football, which is a project I've wanted to take on forever. I grew up in New York. I was a Columbia fan. Rode the subway to games as a kid. They were terrible. But I loved going to the games, and I followed the Ivy League my whole professional career, football and basketball. They've had great success in basketball, as you know. I know the coaches, and I know I'll get. I've already witnessed the fact that they're going to give me complete access throughout the season, and it's a project that I'm already really enjoying. How much it'll sell, I don't know, but Ivy League people do know how to read.
NIL not affecting the Ivy League yet?
No. No, it really isn't. The transfer portal very minimally affecting the Ivy League. In fact, Bob Surace, the Princeton coach, they've got a quarterback this year who is a transfer. He is the first Princeton football transfer since the 1980s. So and the other thing, I knew for sure that the Ivy League would not be expanding or having teams leave during the time I was working on this book. They don't call them the Ancient Eight for nothing.
You know what I love about you, man? You still find romance in all of this, whether it's the Army Navy game, whether it's golf and Faraday being on the other side and now moving back into whatever the mainstream for golf's going to be. But you still love sports, right? Like, yeah, you write about other things and you have other interests, but like sports is what you still do and probably are always going to do.
Yeah, it's always been my passion since I was a kid, Nestor. I mean, when I was growing up, I was going to either be the point guard for the Knicks or the center fielder for the Mets, and found out that wasn't going to happen. And I've been extraordinarily lucky to be able to be involved in sports my entire adult life and get paid for it. I've been in a lot of places doing a lot of things and looked around and said, you know what? I'm getting paid to do something most people would pay to do. And so I've considered myself very lucky that way. And I do still love sports. I'm still passionate, fortunately, about sports. Not as broadly as when I was younger, but I still enjoy I enjoy the games, but Nestor, and you've experienced this, I enjoy getting to know the people. That's the books I've written have always been about people. Faraday is a book about a person and the people in his life. Season on the Brink was about a person who just happened to be a basketball coach. And so I've always said that. And people have said to me, why do your books have success? And I say, because I think they're not just about sports, they're about people who happen to be in sports.
Well, I say this with all love. You're my favorite Oscar Madison. The book.
That's being kind to me in terms of my wardrobe.
You can find him at J. Feinstein Books. You can find him where books are sold. You can Amazon him, Google him. Faraday's the newest from the remarkably funny and tragic journey of golf's David Faraday. Oh, John, always good to see you. Sorry, I'm not seeing it. You NBC games. Hey, I'll tell you this: this Oriole thing, and my last name's Aparicio, so I get it honest.
Right.
But this baseball coming back and the games being 2.5 hours and people stopping me on the streets and wanting to talk about something that's not the Lamarathon, which I dealt with for about 1.5 years. Now it's when are they going to sign Rutschman and give him money, and when are they going to get a lease done? So, there's other issues here, but the baseball team taking front and center, man, that feels familiar to me in a really unfamiliar way because it's been a while and it's neat
Yeah,
for a
no,
while.
you're right. I mean, like I said, I did Oriole games and went to Oriole games in Memorial Stadium for years. Love Camden Yards still. You've been in the press box at Camden Yards. I don't know if you've been in the press box at Nat Stadium,
On the
but
roof, yeah.
you've got to duck airplanes sometimes. So, and it's great to see the Orioles being competitive. It's fun to watch the games again, like you said, because they don't take 3.5 hours, and the Orioles are good. Not so much fun watching my Mets right now, but I'm glad to see the Orioles having not only a competitive team, but a very good team again. It was fun last year when they turned it around and won 83 games. And so, yeah, I'm all for that 100%.
Far be it for me to be the curmudgeon of the two of us, but like I've been doing this 31 years professionally, taking calls, the sports, the whole deal. Very rarely do I say, hey, they made that better. Maybe instant replay made some things better to at least get calls right, to make sure my Mike Renfro catch in the Oiler game gets adjudicated years later. But the baseball thing with the pitch clock, other than maybe the three-pointer and you and I, that'll be our next segment together as to how that changed basketball. I can't remember anything that's been more universally rubber stamped by everybody by saying they finally fixed baseball by
Right.
doing this. There has I can't think of anything. All we can talk about is how everything else is screwed up. This is one thing they kind of brought back, and I'm like, whoa, good for baseball to do something right for the first time.
Yeah, and it took years, as you know, and there were people dug in fighting against it. Baseball is about being timeless and all that. Well, it's gone beyond being timeless. And I was always for a pitch clock. And I like these rules that you can't step off and throw over 14 times. And I think it's all good. It's all good. And like I said, it's weird because sometimes when I'm out, especially when they're afternoon games, I get home and I go to the computer to check scores, or I try to turn on the TV because I have the baseball package to watch a 1 o'clock game at 3:30, and it's over. And that never happened. before this year, and it's a pleasure. It's a pleasure. It really is.
Especially for those of us who love baseball. I mean,
Yeah,
no
exactly.
offense, but get it over with. And I mean, even this runner on second base in the I
I
kind
don't
of
like
hated
that
it.
one. That's the one I don't like.
I kind of hated
Because
it.
it changes the game. It's not baseball. It's like little league or softball or something. That then they put that in during COVID, but when they were having 7-inning double headers, and which I hated, and things like that. But they don't need it. So what if a game goes 13 or 14 innings? It's not like it's going to happen every night. It doesn't.
But I don't have any pitching. What will it do to my bullpen?
Yeah,
A load management.
14 guys in the bullpen.
All
Jeez.
right, John. Take care of yourself. Always good to visit. The book's Faraday. It's Father's Day. And if you're not into golf, he's got a million other books about a million other things you can buy for Father's Day. So go out and check it out. Appreciate you as always. Don't see him as much at UMBC. Maybe the Orioles winning will continue to bring people back to the big city, if not a good concert at CFG Bank Arena. I am Nestor. We are
If you
WNS.
want to know why I'm not at UMBC, go ask Brian Berrio. That's the answer.
Hey, man, I that's it. Drop the mic, John. I'm
Yep.
Nestor. We are WNST AM 1570 Towson Baltimore. Back for more right after this on Baltimore Positive.